You prefer to be serious, Henry? All right. How long do you wish me to exist somewhere in the basement of your life? How lonely do you want me to become? I've asked nothing of you. I've let you live your life as you pleased. Can't you give me one evening? Oh, I know you hate parties and you'll be bored, but it means a great deal to me. Call it empty social vanity. I want to appear for once with my husband. I suppose you never think of it in such terms, but you're an important man. You're envied, hated, respected, and feared. You're a man whom any woman would be proud to show off as her husband. You may say it's a low form of feminine ostentation, but that's the form of any woman's happiness. You don't live by such standards, but I do. Can't you give me this much, at the price of a few hours of boredom? Can't you be strong enough to fulfill your obligation and to perform a husband's duty? Can't you go there not for your own sake but mine? Not because you want to go, but only because I want it? Dagny, he thought desperately. Dagny, who had never said a word about his life at home, who had never made a claim, uttered a reproach, or asked a question. He could not appear before her with his wife. He could not let her see him as the husband being proudly shown off. He wished he could die now, in this moment, before he committed this action, because he knew that he would commit it, because he had accepted his secret as guilt and promised himself to take its consequences, because he had granted that the right was with Lillian, and he was able to bear any form of damnation, but not able to deny the right when it was claimed of him, because he knew that the reason for his refusal to go was the reason that gave him no right to refuse. Because he heard the pleading cry in his mind, "Oh God, Lillian, anything but that party!" And he did not allow himself to beg for mercy. He said evenly, his voice lifeless and firm, "All right, Lillian, I'll go." The wedding veil of Rose Point lace caught on the splintered floor of her tenement bedroom. Cheryl Brooks lifted it cautiously, stepping to look at herself in a crooked mirror that hung on the wall. She had been photographed here all day, as she had been many times in the past 2 months. She still smiled with incredulous gratitude when newspaper people wanted to take her picture, but she wished they would not do it so often. An aging sob sister who had a drippy love column in print and the bitter wisdom of a policewoman in person had taken Cheryl under her protection weeks ago, when the girl had first been thrown into press interviews as into a meat grinder. Today the sob sister had chased the reporters out, had snapped, all right, beat it, at the neighbors, had slammed Cheryl's door in their faces, and had helped her to dress. She was to drive Cheryl to the wedding. She had discovered that there was no one else to do it. The wedding veil, the white satin gown, the delicate slippers and the strand of pearls at her throat had cost 500 times the price of the entire contents of Cheryl's room. A bed took most of the room's space, and the rest was taken by a chest of drawers, one chair, and her few dresses hanging behind a faded curtain. The huge hoop skirt of the wedding gown brushed against the walls when she moved, her slender figure swaying above the skirt in the dramatic contrast of a tight, severe, long-sleeved bodice. The gown had been made by the best designer in the city. "You see, when I got the job in the dime store, I could have moved to a better room," she said to the sob sister in apology. "But I don't think it matters much where you sleep at night, so I save my money because I'll need it for something important in the future." She stopped and smiled, shaking her head dazedly. "I thought I'd need it," she said. "You look fine," said the sob sister. "You can't see much in that alleged mirror, but you're okay. The way all this happened, I haven't had time to catch up with myself, but you see, Jim is wonderful. He doesn't mind it, that I'm only a sales girl from a dime store living in a place like this. He doesn't hold it against me." "Uh-huh," said the sob sister. Her face looked grim. Cheryl remembered the wonder of the first time Jim Taggart had come here. He had come one evening without warning, a month after their first meeting, when she had given up hope of ever seeing him again. She had been miserably embarrassed. She had felt as if she were trying to hold a sunrise within the space of a mud puddle. But Jim had smiled, sitting on her only chair, looking at her flushed face and at her room. Then he had told her to put on her coat, and he had taken her to dinner at the most expensive restaurant in the city. He had smiled at her uncertainty, at her awkwardness, at her terror of picking the wrong fork, and at the look of enchantment in her eyes. She had not known what he thought, but he had known that she was stunned, not by the place, but by his bringing her there. That she barely touched the costly food, that she took the dinner, not as booty from a rich sucker, as all the girls he knew would have taken it, but as some shining award she had never expected to deserve. He had come back to her 2 weeks later, and then their dates had grown progressively more frequent. He would drive up to the dime store at the closing hour, and she would see her fellow salesgirls gaping at her, at his limousine, at the uniformed chauffeur who opened the door for her. He would take her to the best nightclubs, and when he introduced her to his friends, he would say, "Miss Brooks works in the dime store in Madison Square." She would see the strange expressions on their faces, and Jim watching them with a hint of mockery in his eyes. He wanted to spare her the need of pretense or embarrassment, she thought with gratitude. He had the strength to be honest, and not to care whether others approved of him or not, she thought with admiration. But she felt an odd burning pain, new to her. The night she heard some woman who worked for a highbrow political magazine say to her companion at the next table, "How generous of Jim!" Had he wished, she would have given him the only kind of payment she could offer in return. She was grateful that he did not seek it. But she felt as if their relationship was an immense debt, and she had nothing to pay it with except her silent worship. He did not need her worship, she thought. There were evenings when he came to take her out, but remained in her room instead and talked to her, while she listened in silence. It always happened unexpectedly, with a kind of peculiar abruptness, as if he had not intended doing it, but something burst within him, and he had to speak. Then he sat slumped on her bed, unaware of his surroundings and of her presence, yet his eyes jerked to her face once in a while, as if he had to be certain that a living being heard him. "It wasn't for myself, it wasn't for myself at all. Why won't they believe me, those people? I had to grant the union's demands to cut down the trains, and the moratorium on bonds was the only way I could do it, so that's why Wesley gave it to me, for the workers, not for myself. All the newspapers said that I was a great example for all businessmen to follow, a businessman with a sense of social responsibility, that's what they said. It's true, isn't it? Isn't it? What was wrong about that moratorium? What if we did skip a few technicalities? It was for a good purpose. Everyone agrees that anything you do is good, so long as it's not for yourself. But she won't give me credit for a good purpose. She doesn't think anybody's any good except herself. My sister is a ruthless, conceited bitch who won't take anyone's ideas but her own. Why do they keep looking at me that way, she and Reardon and all those people? Why are they so sure they're right? If I acknowledge their superiority in the material realm, why don't they acknowledge mine in the spiritual? They have the brain, but I have the heart. They have the capacity to produce wealth, but I have the capacity to love. Isn't mine the greater capacity? Hasn't it been recognized as the greatest through all the centuries of human history? Why won't they recognize it? Why are they so sure they're great? And if they're great and I'm not, isn't that exactly why they should bow to me because I'm not? Wouldn't that be an act of true humanity? It takes no kindness to respect a man who deserves respect. It's only a payment which he's earned. To give an unearned respect is the supreme gesture of charity. But they're incapable of charity. They're not human. They feel no concern for anyone's need or weakness. No concern and no pity. She could understand little of it. But she understood that he was unhappy and that somebody had hurt him. He saw the pain of tenderness in her face, the pain of indignation against his enemies. And he saw the glance intended for heroes, given to him by a person able to experience the emotion behind that glance. She did not know why she felt certain that she was the only one to whom he could confess his torture. She took it as a special honor, as one more gift. The only way to be worthy of him, she thought, was never to ask him for anything. He offered her money once, and she refused it, with such a bright, painful flare of anger in her eyes, that he did not attempt it again. The anger was at herself. She wondered whether she had done something to make him think she was that kind of person. But she did not want to be ungrateful for his concern, or to embarrass him by her ugly poverty. She wanted to show him her eagerness to rise and justify his favor. So she told him that he could help her if he wished, by helping her to find a better job. He did not answer. In the weeks that followed, she waited, but he never mentioned the subject. She blamed herself. She thought that she had offended him. that he had taken it as an attempt to use him.